Attention listeners, join us at the Shine Music Fest on Saturday, August 24th. Look forward to lots of fun and interactive experiences, including a live recording of the Blind Chick podcast. Learn more and RSVP at www.shinemusicfest.com/event-info.
Welcome. You are listening to the Audio Information Network of Colorado. This recording is intended to be used solely by individuals with barriers to print.
Thank you for joining us for the March 13th Sunday reading of the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler. Today we will be reading the following main articles. Strike near Kyiv. Russians block aid convoy. Port city is reeling. By Mitislav Chernov and Yuris Karmanov. Ukraine. White House approves $200 million in arms and equipment by Eric Schmidt. Rush to buy bomb shelters, iodine replaces COVID fears by Jason Horowitz. Suncor's Commerce City Refinery, air monitoring ramping up. New pollution permit to bring more challenges for company. Nearby residents still skeptical by Noel Phillips. And following up with miscellaneous articles. Strike near Kyiv. Russians block aid convoy. Port city is reeling. By Mstislav Chernov and Yuris Karmanov. The Associated Press, byline Mariupol, Ukraine. Russian forces pounded the Ukrainian port city of Mariupol on Saturday, shelling its downtown as residents hid in an iconic mosque and elsewhere to avoid the explosions. Fighting also raged in the outskirts of the capital, Kyiv, as Russia kept up its bombardment of other cities throughout the country. Mariupol has endured some of the Ukraine's worst punishment since Russia invaded. Unceasing barrages have thwarted repeated attempts to bring food, water, and medicine into the city of 430,000 and to evacuate its trapped civilians. More than 1,500 people have died in Mariupol during the siege, according to the mayor's office, and the shelling has even interrupted efforts to bury the dead in mass graves. Talks aimed at reaching a ceasefire again failed Saturday. Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky accused Russia of employing a new stage of terror with the alleged detention of a mayor from a city west of Mariupol. Russian soldiers pillaged a humanitarian convoy that was trying to reach Mariupol and blocked another, a Ukrainian official said. Ukraine's military said Russian forces captured Mariupol's eastern outskirts, tightening their siege of the strategic port. Taking Mariupol and other ports on the Azov Sea could allow Russia to establish a land corridor to Crimea, which it seized from Ukraine in 2014. They are bombing Mariupol 24 hours a day, launching missiles. It is hatred. They kill children, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky said. Satellite images released Saturday by the company Maxar showed fires in parts of the city and extensive damage to apartments, homes, and other infrastructure. An Associated Press journalist in Mariupol witnessed tanks firing on a 9-story apartment building and was with a group of hospital workers who came under sniper fire Friday. A worker shot in the hip survived, but conditions in the hospital were deteriorating. Electricity was reserved for operating tables, and people with nowhere else to go lined the hallways. Among them was Anastasia Arizhova, who wept and trembled as she held a sleeping child. Shelling had just killed her other child, as well as her brother's child, Arizhova said, her scalp crusted with blood. No one was able to save them, she said. In Irpin, a suburb about 12 miles northwest of central Kyiv, bodies lay in the open Saturday on streets and in a park. When I woke up in the morning, everything was covered in smoke. Everything was dark. We don't know who is shooting and where, resident Serhiy Protsenko said as he walked through his neighborhood. Explosions sounded in the distance. We don't have any radio or information. Zelensky encouraged his people to keep up their resistance. We do not have the right to let up our defense, no matter how difficult it may be, he said. Later Saturday, Zelensky reported that 1,300 Ukrainian soldiers had died since the Russian invasion began February 24th. Zelensky again deplored NATO's refusal to declare a no-fly zone over Ukraine and said Ukraine has sought ways to procure air defense assets, although he didn't elaborate. NATO has said imposing a no-fly zone could lead to a wider war with Russia. The Ukrainian president also accused Russia of detaining the mayor of Melitopol, a city 119 miles west of Mariupol. The Ukrainian leader called on Russian forces to heed calls from demonstrators in the occupied city for the mayor's release. In multiple areas around Kyiv, artillery barrages sent residents scurrying for shelter as air raid sirens wailed. Britain's defense ministry said Russian forces that had been massed north of the capital had wedged within 15 miles of the city center and spread out, likely to support an attempted encirclement. A convoy of hundreds of people fleeing Priyamoha, about 12 miles northeast of Kyiv, were forced to turn back under shelling by Russian forces that killed 7 people, including a child, Ukraine's defense ministry said Saturday. Moscow has said it would establish humanitarian corridors out of conflict zones, but Ukrainian officials have accused Russia of disrupting those paths and firing on civilians. Ukraine's Deputy Prime Minister Irina Vereshchuk said just 9 of 14 agreed-upon corridors were open Saturday, and that about 13,000 people had used them to evacuate around the country. Ukraine's military and volunteer forces have been preparing for an all-out assault on the capital. Kyiv Mayor Vitali Klitschko said Thursday that about 2 million people, half the metropolitan area's inhabitants, had left, and that every street, every house, is being fortified. Zelensky said Saturday that Russia would need to carpet bomb Kyiv and kill its residents to take the city. They will come here only if they kill us all, he said. If that is their goal, let them come. French and German leaders spoke Saturday with Russian President Vladimir Putin in a failed attempt to reach a ceasefire. According to the Kremlin, Putin laid out terms for ending the war. For ending hostilities, Moscow has demanded that Ukraine drop its bid to join NATO and adopt a neutral status, acknowledge the Russian sovereignty over Crimea, which it annexed from Ukraine in 2014, recognize the independence of separatist regions in the country's east, and agree to demilitarize. Zelensky told Israeli Prime Minister Naftali Bennett on Saturday that he would be open to meeting Putin in Jerusalem to discuss an end to the war, but there would first have to be a ceasefire. Bennett recently met in Moscow with Putin, who has ignored previous offers of talks from Zelensky. Ukraine. White House approves $200 million in arms, equipment, by Eric Schmidt, The New York Times Company, byline, Washington. The White House has approved an additional $200 million in arms and equipment for Ukraine, administration officials said Saturday, responding to urgent requests from President Volodymyr Zelensky for more aid to stave off the Russian invasion. The latest arms package, which officials say includes Javelin anti-tank missiles and Stinger anti-aircraft missiles, follows a $350 million arms package the Biden administration approved last month. Altogether, the administration has sent $1.2 billion in weapons to Ukraine in the past year, officials said. The weapons come from existing U.S. military stockpiles in Europe and are flown to neighboring countries such as Poland and Romania, where they are shipped overland into western Ukraine. In less than a week at the beginning of the Russian assault, the United States and NATO pushed more than 17,000 anti-tank weapons, including javelins, into the hands of Ukrainian commanders. Russia has so far not attacked these shipments because its forces have been too busy fighting in other parts of Ukraine, Pentagon officials said. But Saturday, according to the Interfax news agency, Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Ryabkov warned that Moscow would start firing on such shipments, stirring fears of an escalation to the conflict. The West has rejected Zelensky's repeated pleas to enforce a no-fly zone over Ukraine and to provide Ukraine with Polish MiG-29 fighter jets out of fear of drawing the United States and NATO into a direct confrontation with Russia, a nuclear power. Instead, the Biden administration and 14 other allies have sent anti-tank and anti-aircraft weapons that analysts say have been effective at attacking Russian military might on the ground and in the air. Pentagon officials said they were working closely with Eastern European nations, in particular, to provide more surface-to-air missile defenses to Ukraine, adding that such deliveries could be announced in the next few days. Rush to buy bomb shelters, iodine replaces COVID fears, by Jason Horowitz, the New York Times company, Bonolo San Vito, Italy. Across a footbridge from a busy shopping outlet surrounded by verdant fields in northern Italy, workers in a nondescript warehouse are preparing for a nuclear attack, its radioactive fallout, and the end of the world as we know it. We have found ourselves in the midst of this giant cyclone of demand, said Giulio Cavaccioli, as he shows off an underground air filtration system that cleans radioactive particles, nerve gas, and other biological agents, and played a video tour of a nuclear shelter that was ready to use. His company, Minus Energy, has gone from working on 50 bunkers in the past 22 years to fielding 500 inquiries in the past 2 weeks. It's an hysteria for construction of bunkers, he said, driven by the fear of Russian nuclear warheads reaching across Europe. It's much scarier now. In the days since President Vladimir Putin of Russia launched his war on Ukraine and put his nuclear forces into special combat readiness, the intensifying violence and the legacy of two world wars has revived fears in Europe of nuclear calamity for the first time in decades. Europe has spent 2 years on high alert against the pandemic. But now the manifestations of its anxieties and desires for self-defense have shifted from the masks, vaccines, and lockdowns of COVID-19 to the bunkers, iodine pills, and air raid sirens of nuclear war. From Italy to Sweden, Belgium to Britain, the specter of nuclear war, which had seemed a relic of the past, is permeating a new generation of European consciousness. And it is prompting a new look at defense infrastructure, survival guides, and fallout shelters that not long ago were a purview of camouflage-wearing, assault weapon-toting survivalists, or paranoid billionaires. We are extremely concerned by the nuclear safety, security, and safeguards risk caused by the Russian invasion on Ukraine, the European Union said in statement Wednesday. Since the fall of the Soviet Union, we've all forgotten about it and put it to bed until, you know, the madman invaded, said Hamish de Breton Gordon, the former commander of the United Kingdom's and NATO's chemical, biological, and nuclear defense forces, and now a visiting fellow at Magdalene College, Cambridge. He said bunkers across Europe have fallen into disrepair and were decayed. We are completely unprepared, de Breton Gordon said. But each day that it goes forward, it's becoming more of a reality that actually this is something maybe we need to think about in some detail. Countries that sit closer to Russia are thinking about it. Finland, on Russia's western border, has maintained high military readiness for years, regularly testing alarms, and has a long tradition of preparedness, according to Petri Toivonen, the Secretary General for Finland's Secretariat of the Security Committee. He wrote in an email that we have been continuously constructing shelters. He added that at the moment our capacity is for approximately 4 million people in approximately 50,000 shelters. In Sweden, Russia's annexation of Crimea jump-started a total defense strategy that had eased after the fall of the Soviet Union. Now, Sweden's Civil Contingencies Agency is testing its air raid warning system and circulating a precautionary pamphlet reminiscent of the Cold War era. The 20-page guide includes a checklist for basic supplies to get from the supermarket to survive on the run or in a shelter. Outside the bunkers, others are seeking protection from iodine pills, which, when taken correctly, can help absorb radiation in the thyroid and help prevent cancer from exposure to it. Belgium is meeting a sharp increase in demand with packs of pills free for anyone with a Belgian identity card. Michael Storm, an official with the country's pharmacists union, told the Belgian news agency Belga that Monday alone, the country's pharmacies distributed more than 30,000 boxes. Demand has also gone up in the Netherlands and Finland. Suncor's Commerce City refinery, air monitoring ramping up. New pollution permit to bring more challenges for company. Nearby residents still skeptical. By Noel Phillips, The Denver Post. After years of spewing toxic pollutants, Suncor's aging Commerce City oil refinery now will be the focus of three separate air quality monitoring programs, the latest mandated by a 2021 state law. Suncor executives and Colorado Air Pollution Control Division officials have been meeting with residents to discuss a new plan to install air monitors along the refinery's nearly 3.4-mile perimeter to measure levels of benzene, hydrogen sulfide, and hydrogen cyanide, chemicals that can cause cancer, breathing difficulties, headaches, and other long-term illnesses, depending on the amount and length of time a person is exposed to them. On top of the state's new fence line monitoring, Suncor late last summer launched a self-monitoring program that includes 10 testing sites within a 3-mile radius of the plant. And a community organization, Cultivando, is now running its own independent program to monitor the air quality around the 90-year-old refinery. Suncor presents a monumental challenge to Colorado. Michael Ogletree, director of the state's Air Pollution Control Division, said at the start of a public hearing Wednesday night. The refinery just north of Denver is the largest source of air pollution in the state, and its location in an urban area makes its pollution disproportionately affect a low-income minority population, perpetuating years of environmental injustice, he said. The company is failing to meet high environmental standards amid a corporate culture that accepts routine violations of air emission standards, Ogletree said. This needs to change, and Suncor can't continue with business as usual or enacting half measures to improve performance, he said. What is needed is an aggressive and continual approach to improving performance built on sound science and a commitment to eliminating noncompliance and establishing additional measures to reduce emissions from the facility. And the state needs to use its power to ensure that this happens. Suncor's executives pledged to comply with the new monitoring requirements, and they say the company will use the latest and best technology available. About 60 people attended the Wednesday night meeting to hear how Suncor proposes to install air monitors along its perimeter and to offer feedback on the plan. Many were skeptical that the company and the state can be trusted as watchdogs. The public may also submit written comments through April 5th by emailing cdphe.comments@state.co.us. Meanwhile, Suncor has been operating the refinery for years on an expired air pollution permit. Early last month, the Air Quality Control Division sent a proposed permit renewal to the Environmental Protection Agency for approval. The EPA will finish its review March 26 and send the draft permit back to the state with any recommended revisions. Already, the air permit renewal is being criticized by community activists because it won't be more restrictive on Suncor and would allow the company to continue to violate the Federal Clean Air Act. The state, however, has said the proposed permit would crack down on some emissions while increasing the limits on others. If approved by the EPA, the new permit would raise the refinery's permissible limits of volatile organic compounds, which form ground-level ozone, by 138 tons per year and allow 11 tons more per year of particulate soot. The new permit would reduce the amount of sulfur dioxide and carbon monoxide that can be emitted by the facility. Colorado also is working on a new water quality permit for Suncor that officials hope would place tighter restrictions on the refinery when it comes to water contamination. The state wants the new permit to require more transparency surrounding the refinery's operations and impose more pollution monitoring systems, as well as limits for toxic metals and chemicals. The facility sits along Sand Creek in Adams County, and the state wants to better protect the creek and the waterways it reaches as it flows downstream. Even with the new monitoring and potentially more restrictive permits coming, neighbors remain leery about Suncor's willingness to change and the government's will to force the company into compliance. The city and county did nothing for the community while Suncor was running with expired permits for years, Commerce City resident Lucy Molina said in an interview with the Denver Post. And Suncor never bothered to monitor or report itself until community pressure picked up over the past few years, she said. Self-regulation does not work. Self-monitoring does not work. They've been doing that for a century, Molina said. As a community, as an impacted citizen, can I trust Suncor? Absolutely not. Can I trust the state? Absolutely, expletive deleted, not. Fence line monitoring. Last June, Governor Jared Polis signed a law that requires Suncor and other industrial facilities in Colorado that reach a specific threshold for releasing toxins into the air to establish monitoring plans around the perimeters. Suncor was required to create its monitoring program before three other companies that will be affected by the law. Suncor will build sheltered stations along the refinery's fence line that will monitor benzene, hydrogen sulfide, and hydrogen cyanide emissions. Instruments inside those stations will project light beams along the fence line that will hit mirrors and bounce light waves back to an analyzer, which will detect chemicals in the air based on light absorption, Suncor officials said during Wednesday's presentation. There will be 10 analyzers inside five shelters around the refinery's nearly 3.4-mile perimeter, and results will be shared in near real time on a website that will be in English and Spanish. The system must be operational by January 1st. The company must also establish an emergency notification system so people who live near the refinery can receive alerts when toxic emissions exceed permitted levels. Self-monitoring. In August, Suncor stood up a self-monitoring program by installing 9 air monitoring stations within 3 miles of the plant and creating a van decked out with the latest air sensors to roam neighborhoods near the plant. The company hired Montrose Environmental to run the monitoring stations and report the emissions its instruments record. That information is updated online at ccnd-air.com. The fixed monitoring stations are measuring carbon monoxide, sulfur dioxide, hydrogen sulfide, nitrogen oxide, nitrogen dioxide, particulate matter, and total volatile organic compounds, while the van periodically measures ethane, ethene, propane, benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, xylene, and hydrogen cyanide. During a February media briefing on the new program, Donald Austin, vice president of Suncor's Commerce City Refinery, said the data will help the company understand air quality conditions around the facility. It was important, he said, to hire an independent company to do the work. This has got to be science-based, and we've got to have independent experts, Austin said. This brings credibility to the process. Suncor is committed to continually improving the air monitoring program, he said, and the company will let the data guide the program and the company's response. Community monitoring. After years of violations on how much and what kinds of pollutant the company emits, the refinery's neighbors are skeptical of Suncor's self-monitoring program. As part of a $9 million settlement for air pollution violations, Suncor gave money to a community group that also is monitoring air quality in neighborhoods around the plant. Cultivando, a nonprofit Latino advocacy group, is monitoring Suncor's air emissions through one fixed station and a trailer with monitoring equipment that can be moved around the community. The group puts its findings on its website, boldair.com/commerce_city.htm, in real time. The group also places measuring devices in homes and schools. The Cultivando trailer recently parked in Melina's yard. She was thrilled to have it measuring Suncor's emissions, which she blames for generations of health problems in her family. "Seeing that in my yard, I was like, okay, it's real," Melina said. "Standing together and being united, we can bring environmental justice." 2021 homicides. Denver killings highest since 1981. Arguments, domestic violence, and drugs led to 96 deaths as the city's rate is trending upward. By Lee Schmelzer, The Denver Post. 96 people died in Denver homicides last year, the highest number since 1981, and a toll that has left dozens more families devastated by the elevated level of violence that has ripped through the city during the past 2 years. The victims included a real estate agent, a teacher, a Coors Field concessionaire, an accountant, mothers, fathers, and teenagers. The youngest victim, Atlas Grooms, was 1 month old when her father shot and killed her along with her mother, a nurse. The oldest, William Stu Hobel, was 77 years old when he was strangled in his basement by a man he knew. He always did things his own way, without apology or protest, just his simple yet powerful inner fire that burned bright, Hobel's obituary states. People often described him as fearless, the kind of person who made things happen, and one of the few they had ever known who would do whatever he set his mind to. The deadly violence last year continued a sharp spike in the number of killings in the city that began in 2020, when the number of homicides rocketed to 95 from the 63 recorded in 2019. Non-fatal shootings, too, remained more frequent than average in Denver last year, although they did drop from 2020 levels, according to police data recently obtained by the Denver Post through a public records request. The number of homicides has trended upward since 2014, when the city experienced a record low number of 31 killings, according to data collected by the Post. Denver recorded 100 homicides in 1981, the highest on record for the city. The per capita rate of 13 homicides per 100,000 residents last year is the highest since 2004, when the rate was 16 killings per 100,000, though the current rate still is lower than those recorded in the early 1980s and 1990s. The increases of the past 2 years are significant and should not be allowed to become normal. Denver Police Chief Paul Pazin said, "That is not fine," he said of the homicide numbers. "That is not okay." Increases in domestic violence killings and homicides involving narcotics help fuel the number, according to a Denver police analysis. Denver police also attributed 22 homicides to arguments or confrontations that spun out of control. The most common underlying causal factor in 2021. "We're seeing individuals involved in these altercations had firearms with them, and they resort to those firearms early on," said Denver Police Commander Matt Clark of the Major Crimes Division. "They're resolving these conflicts through the use of a firearm." A review of homicide arrest affidavits shows the alleged motives and circumstances for killings vary widely. In one case, a woman is accused of shooting and killing a man she believed was checking the door handle of her relative's car. In another case, the man allegedly killed another because he thought the victim had stolen a friend's cell phone. Another man killed a friend after an argument about whether the victim had broken a window on a truck. One suspect allegedly killed his father while experiencing schizophrenic delusions. "I don't think there's a distinctive pattern," Denver District Attorney Beth McCann said, "I do think the stress and frustration and anxiety that people have been feeling over the last couple years because of the pandemic and the economic uncertainty has definitely contributed. I think that's probably a fairly large part of it." Danger at home. 15 people were killed in domestic violence incidents in 2021, the highest number of domestic violence homicides in the city in at least the past 6 years. It's nearly double the average recorded over the prior 3 years. At least 7 children were left orphans by the violence, with their parents either dead or in jail. Organizations that provide support to people experiencing abuse have worked hard to meet fluctuating needs during the pandemic, which forced many to rethink how they provide services, said Abigail Hansen, Chief Program Officer of Safe House Denver. The nonprofit organization has seen fewer new clients reach out during the pandemic, but Hansen said that might mean fewer people are in a safe position to ask for help. There's definitely not less domestic violence happening. I can say that with certainty, Hansen said. Service providers at Safe House have found circumstances for existing clients became even more complex during the pandemic and the abuse more egregious. Survivors were further destabilized as they lost childcare, jobs, and mobility and faced more isolation, she said. Physical violence increased, but so did other equally dangerous forms of abuse. Manipulation, emotional and verbal abuse, financial abuse. When domestic violence happens, it is a potentially lethal event each and every time, she said. The vast majority of 2021 homicide victims knew their killers, according to Denver police data. Of the 56 incidents in which the victim-suspect relationship is known, 77% of the suspects knew their killers. Guns were the most common weapon used to kill people and were used in 85% of homicides last year. Gang-motivated homicides in the city plummeted in 2021, according to Denver police data. But Pazin said that doesn't mean that gang violence has ebbed. The number of gang-motivated non-fatal shootings has risen, he said. By no means are we saying that gang homicides are down, and that's an indicative trend showing gang activity is decreasing, Pazin said. That's not the case. The department defines gang-motivated homicides as killings that were done to further the status or finances of a gang or reflect rivalries between two groups, Clark said. That definition doesn't include all homicides where a gang member was killed or is suspected of the killing. Denver police analysis shows that 15 of those killed in homicides last year were gang members or affiliated with gangs, as were 17 homicide suspects. 3 of the suspects and 1 of the victims were minors. 32 of the suspects were on probation, parole, or pretrial release, according to Denver police data. Pazin said that number was concerning and that Colorado needs to examine whether pretrial, probation, and parole agencies have enough resources to monitor their clients effectively and deter them from criminal activity. We as a state need to figure out what's working and what's not working, Pazin said. If we have more than 30 individuals that are continuing criminal behavior, including homicide, and they are in some form of supervision, then what is happening? The data also shows that 15 homicide victims were experiencing homelessness. 8 suspects were experiencing homelessness, including a man charged with stabbing a Denver Rescue Mission worker. Pazin and McCann pointed to the proliferation of guns as a potential factor in the violence. Beyond homicides, at least 228 people were shot last year but survived their injuries, down 24% from 2020, but slightly above the 3-year average of 206. Nearly a quarter of those wounded by gunfire were teenagers, according to Denver police data obtained by the Post. Assaults with a firearm are driving up the number of aggravated assaults in the city, which includes any attack that caused serious injury. Against the 3-year average, aggravated assaults are up 27.4%, Pazin said. But aggravated assaults with a firearm, which include incidents when someone fires a gun but does not hit anyone, spiked ever further and are up 55% over a 3-year average. That is like, oh my gosh, what is going on? The chief said. Are cases being solved? Despite the record number of homicides, Denver police detectives' ability to solve the cases has not dropped. As of March 1st, 66 of last year's 96 homicides have been cleared, for a clearance rate of 69%. A homicide is considered cleared if an arrest is made, if the suspect is dead, or if police identify a suspect but the district attorney declines to prosecute the case. Police said they have viable information about a suspect's identity in 8 of the 30 cases that remain open. The 2021 clearance rate of 69% is on par with the 70% rate for 2020 as of early 2021 and slightly below the 80% clearance rate of 2019. 12 cases were cleared in 2021 because a suspect was believed to have been acting in self-defense. 9 cases were cleared because the suspect died. The number of such clearances, called clearance by exceptional means, is unusually high, Clark said. I think by and large, the investigative team was in agreement with the district attorney's decisions in terms of what cases we could overcome self-defense claims, he said. Prosecutors have an ethical duty not to file cases they don't think they can prove in court, McCann said. In cases that involve a self-defense claim, prosecutors must prove that the defendant was not acting in self-defense or to defend others and that their actions were not reasonable. Prosecutors have to consider who initiated the aggression and the danger of the threats they face. For example, the district attorney's office last year declined to prosecute a man who killed a man who was choking his sister. The man choking the woman had a history of abusing her, McCann said. We have to be cognizant of our ethical obligations, she said. National comparison. Denver is not the only city in Colorado or across the U.S. to experience a sharp rise in killings in the past 2 years. Aurora and Colorado Springs saw significant increases in homicides in 2020. 16 of the 22 cities studied by the Council on Criminal Justice reported a rise in homicides last year compared with 2020, ranging from increases of 108% in St. Petersburg, Florida, to less than 1% in Memphis, Tennessee, and Baltimore. 6 cities saw declines. Criminologists have said it's difficult to pinpoint exactly what is driving the increased violence. They have pointed to a variety of possible factors, including societal stresses from the pandemic, fallout from the 2020 protests of police, a worsening drug use epidemic, and the continuous influx of guns into communities. Others in Colorado and elsewhere have attempted to pin the violence on specific criminal justice reform efforts. The Council on Criminal Justice report notes that homicide rates in most cities, including Denver, are still lower than they were in the 1990s. But Denver should be experiencing an extremely low violent crime rate compared with 30 years ago because of the evolution of crime-fighting technology and research, Pazin said. Investigators now can use DNA, gunshot detectors, federal databases, and cell phone tower data, he said. The advancements that we've had, we should be way below these numbers, he said. In news briefs, suspect in robbery of armored truck in Greenwood Village is arrested. A suspect in an armed robbery of an armored truck in Greenwood Village was arrested last week in New Mexico. Justin White was arrested in connection to an October 30, 2019 robbery of a Brinks truck, according to the U.S. Attorney's Office in Colorado. The frightening, lightning-quick robbery happened about 2:30 p.m. in a parking lot at the Bank of Colorado, 5201 South Yosemite Street, according to the FBI. A startled guard was ordered to the ground as a robber held a gun to her head while the truck was ransacked. Two of the robbers were armed with semi-automatic handguns and the other brandished an AK-47 variant. They fled in an SUV with a stolen license plate. This year, a federal grand jury in Denver issued an indictment charging 4 suspects, Jamarius Jones, David Taylor, Jimmy Garrison, and White, the U.S. Attorney's Office said Saturday in a news release. All of the defendants have been arrested. Skunk tests positive for rabies, Byline, Boulder County. The first detected case of rabies in Boulder County this year came Friday as a skunk exhibiting erratic behavior tested positive for the disease. An animal owner in Boulder saw the animal going to homes in the Table Mesa neighborhood March 6th and called the city's Animal Protection Division. Shortly after, an animal control officer submitted the animal to Boulder County Public Health for rabies testing. Pedestrian hit and killed by vehicle on I-25. A pedestrian was hit and killed by a vehicle early Saturday in Denver. The fatal collision happened on southbound Interstate 25 at West Alameda Avenue, Denver police said at 3:15 a.m. The incident partially shut down the highway, with all lanes reopening in about 90 minutes. Aldine Kid Rock to headline Cheyenne Frontier Days concerts. Organizers of Cheyenne Frontier Days have announced the artists performing at the popular rodeo, concert, and carnival event. Country singer-songwriters Jason Aldean and Gabby Barrett will be kicking things off July 22nd, followed by Dierks Bentley on July 23rd, Kid Rock and Night Ranger on July 27th, and Brooks and Dunn on July 30th, among others. Tickets for concerts go on sale at 9 a.m. Wednesday online. Prices range from $54 to $105. Pro rodeo events will be held July 25th through 26th. Tickets from $18 to $43 will be sold online. These briefs were from Staff and Wire Reports. Boulder moving forward on replacing outdated number 3 fire station by Deborah Swearingen, The Daily Camera. Boulder hopes to begin construction on a new fire station this summer. Boulder Fire Rescue Station number 3, which will be relocated to two parcels on 30th Street, south of Valmont Road, will replace the current fire station number 3, which is outdated, inefficient, and in the high hazard and 100-year floodplain, among other things. The current station is a bit farther south on 30th Street. The new building will be two stories and 28,370 square feet, with one row of parking on the south side and two rows near the rear of the building. Part of the funding for the approximately $18 million project was included in the 2017 Community Culture and Safety Tax Extension. Boulder bought the land in 2018. The concept plan was approved by the Planning Board in 2020. There was a brief discussion in the City Council's meeting on Tuesday about whether to call the item up for further review. Ultimately, however, the City Council decided against it. Doing so could delay the project by at least 90 days, planning staffers said. And in light of the recent Marshall Fire, City Council members said there's a particular sense of urgency for infrastructure to support the fire department. The span of a few months may actually make a difference, Councilmember Nicole Spear said. Boulder, shortest parade returns with new host by Kayleen McCourt, The Daily Camera. In recent years, the pandemic has cramped the style of holiday festivities. As luck would have it, the world's shortest St. Patrick's Day parade will return to downtown Boulder starting at noon today under the direction of new host Independent Order of Odd Fellows, Boulder Lodge No. 9. I'm most looking forward to this year having a fun, safe event that returns to all the fun of years past and also sets the precedent for bigger, even more fun events in the future, said Jim Carr, Vice Grand Noble of the Odd Fellows. I've been attending the St. Paddy Day events with my wife and kids for decades, including all the fun stuff inside Connor O'Neill's Irish pub in the old days. The parade route is on 16th Street between Pearl Street and Spruce Street, one block along the east side of the Odd Fellows Lodge, 1543 Pearl Street. According to Boulder legend, this tradition dates back to a time when patrons at the now-shuttered J.J. McCabe's rose from their bar stools and decided to take an impromptu jaunt around the block in honor of St. Patrick's Day. Over time, the event, spanning nearly four decades, was hosted by Connor O'Neill's Irish Pub and Boulder Beer Company. With the Irish Pub no longer in business and Boulder Beer shuttering its taproom, the Odd Fellows planned to take it over March 2020, only to have canceled it because of the pandemic. Now, organizers are excited for what will be an unforgettable comeback. This year, I'm even joining the Lawn Chair Brigade to march in the parade as an even more active participant, Carr said. The Lawn Chair Brigade, also known as Patty O'Furniture Drill Team, brilliantly utilizes vintage foldable seats as props within dazzling routines. Decked out in green swag, wigs, feather boas, and sometimes leprechaun-inspired frocks, the quirky crew has been known to stomp, shuffle, and sway to Razzle Dazzle and We Will Shamrock You. All the favorites will be returning, no additions, just the traditions, and the only thing new is the location, thanks to the fellas at Odd Fellows, said longtime parade organizer Mary Rios. Mask wearing will be optional, and attendees can look forward to seeing McTaggart Irish dancers, hula dancers, live music, possibly a bike cruiser ride, and more. The regular participants are always eager to confirm their entry well before we have confirmed the event, Rios said. Even before the I's are dotted and the T's are crossed on the invitation emails, a resounding yes, we are in, can be found behind the inbox. A pack of Irish wolfhounds will start off the jovial stroll. I'm looking forward to the Irish eyes and smiles, dancers and bagpipers sharing the stage, hulas in march, and the drill team making us laugh, Rios said. In other news briefs, thousands of Russian tourists stuck in Thailand. Byline, Bangkok. Thousands of Russian tourists are stranded in Thailand's beach resorts because of the war in Ukraine, many unable to pay their bills or return home because of sanctions and canceled flights. The crisis in Europe also put a crimp in recovery plans for the Southeast Asian nation's tourism industry, which has hosted more visitors from Russia than any of its neighbors before the pandemic hit. There are about 6,500 Russian tourists stuck in Phuket, Surat Thani, Krabi, and Pattaya, four provinces that are popular seaside resort destinations, in addition to 1,000 Ukrainians. Uthasak Supasorn, governor of the Tourism Authority of Thailand, told the Associated Press on Friday. Some 17,599 Russians accounted for the largest block of arrivals in February, representing 8.6% of the total 203,970, according to the Public Health Ministry. After the February 24th Russian invasion of Ukraine, their numbers drastically declined. Uthasak said the Russians face two main problems: cancellations of their flights home by airlines that have stopped flying to Russia, and suspension of financial services, particularly by credit card companies that have joined sanctions against Moscow. There are also some who prefer to delay their return. The problems associated with the war in Ukraine have compounded Thailand's hopes for economic recovery. Thai authorities later this year expect to drop most quarantine and testing regulations that have been in place to fight the spread of the virus, which would make entry easier for foreign travelers. As companies leave Russia, their assets could be seized. Hundreds of companies have announced plans to curtail ties with Russia, with the pace accelerating over the past week. Russian President Vladimir Putin responded Thursday by saying that if foreign companies shut down production in Russia, he favored a plan to bring in outside management and then transfer these companies to those who want to work. A draft law could allow Russian courts to appoint external administrators for companies that cease operations and are at least 25% foreign-owned. If the owners refuse to resume operations or to sell, the company's shares could be auctioned off, the ruling United Russia Party has said, calling it the first step toward nationalization. Chris Weifer of Macro Advisory, a consultancy specializing in Russia, said the Russian government is adopting a carrot-and-stick approach to foreign business, with talk of nationalization balanced out with government help for those who stay. A key reason, Weifer said, is that the Kremlin's desire is to avoid mass unemployment. Czech Republic asks EU for modular housing for refugees. Byline, Prague. The Czech Republic is asking the European Union to provide it with modular containers to house the refugees fleeing the war in Ukraine. Interior Minister Vic Rakusan said Saturday his country has requested containers to house up to 50,000 people, as all other options have been coming to an end amid a massive wave of some 200,000 refugees. Rakusan previously said the Czechs are ready to take care of some 250,000 refugees. Pope Pleads for War's End, byline Vatican City. Pope Francis is renewing calls for an end to the war in Ukraine, emphasizing the impact on children. In a tweet on Saturday, he wrote, "Never war. Think first about the children, about those who are deprived of the hope for a dignified life, dead or wounded children, orphans, children who play with the remnants of war." Francis added, "In the name of God, stop." Ukrainian officials and the UN Human Rights Office say dozens of children have been killed since the start of the war. These reports were from Denver Post Wire Services. Colorado nursing homes. It's a struggle on a daily basis. Pandemic made staffing crisis from low pay, low federal aid worse. By Meg Wingerter, The Denver Post. It's never been easy finding workers willing to help others with their most personal bodily functions for not much more than they'd earn at a fast food restaurant. But the pandemic pushed staffing at Colorado's nursing homes from tight to a near crisis. The state's nursing homes were hit harder than almost any other institution during the pandemic, with almost 28,000 infections and more than 1,900 deaths among residents and workers attributed to COVID-19 since April 2020. More than 2,000 people working in Colorado nursing homes have left the industry since the start of the pandemic in March 2020, forcing some homes to stop accepting new residents and straining care for those already living in them. The situation isn't expected to improve much during the current lull in COVID-19 infections, and both owners and employees of nursing homes are skeptical of a new proposal by the Biden administration to boost staffing. Megan Emmerich, who retired in November after 30 years working as an administrative nurse focused on quality improvement in a Fort Collins nursing home, said it's going to be difficult to hire new workers. Hospitals are recruiting nurses aggressively and raising their wages, and the rates Medicaid pays to nursing homes make it impossible to compete, she said. "I think long-term care is in a bind that many other healthcare facilities aren't," Emmerich said. President Joe Biden's plan to build up staffing would require the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services to propose minimum staffing levels for nursing homes within the next year. The federal government would also increase some penalties for repeat violations of quality rules and give states more money to conduct inspections. For too long, corporate owners and operators have not been held to account for poor nursing home performance, the White House said in a fact sheet. Nate Schema, CEO of the Good Samaritan Society, said new staffing mandates would push more nursing homes out of business, especially if they came without additional money. Staffing shortages led the Good Samaritan Society to close its Greeley campus recently and halt new admissions at its Fort Collins location for much of the past 2 months, he said. "It would be a death sentence for many of our nursing homes," he said. Schema said the Good Samaritan Society's nursing homes in Colorado and 21 other states would like to hire more people, but right now they can't find takers for about 2,500 jobs that are already open across the organization. "Our staffing challenges have been nothing short of extraordinary," he said. "It's a struggle on a daily basis. Absolutely fundamental." Jayla Sanchez-Warren, director of the Area Agency on Aging, serving Denver and seven surrounding counties, said advocates have pushed for higher staffing ratios for 3 decades, but it's generally gone nowhere because of opposition from the nursing home industry and concerns about how much more Medicaid might have to pay. "The issue has become more urgent over time because people are living in their homes for longer, making the average nursing home resident older and sicker than they were when the debate started," she said. "The current federal standard is that homes should have a nurse available for at least 8 hours each day and enough workers to provide 2 hours of care to each resident," Sanchez-Warren said. "While that might sound like a lot of attention, some residents are dependent on staff members for things even as basic as turning them in bed, so they don't develop wounds from lying in one position for too long," she said. "Staffing is absolutely fundamental. It's the most important thing in a nursing home," she said. People who don't work in nursing homes don't always understand the amount of work that goes into caring for residents, said a Front Range nurse who has worked in the industry for 30 years. She spoke on the condition of anonymity over fear of retaliation by her employer. The situation has improved a bit since last year because nursing homes no longer have to worry about staffing separate units for residents with COVID-19. But it's still not unusual to be responsible for 20 patients, the nurse said. Ideally, each nurse should have about half that many because they need to oversee medication distribution, make sure those who have medical appointments get to them, clean and bandage any pressure sores and wounds residents have, help with hygiene care, and talk to residents who are lonely, she said. Generally, residents understand when they have to wait for assistance, but it's frustrating for staffers, and family members sometimes yell at the caregivers for delays that aren't under their control, the nurse said. She's skeptical anything will change in the near future and said federal officials have said they would study the problem of low staffing multiple times with no noticeable results. This has been going on forever, she said. Thank you for joining us for the Denver Post. My name is Diane Adler.